Good morning, and you are tuning in to Listen Local. I'm your host, Julian Mark, and joining me today is Charlotte Silver. How are you doing, Charlotte?
I'm doing well. How are you, Julian?
I'm doing okay. I'm just trying to wake up. My sleep hasn't been the best lately, I'm happy to be here with you, and it's a really nice morning this morning.
It is. It's not too hot.
Not too hot, kind of overcast, and the mission is, you know, it's just kind of doing its thing this morning.
Mm-hmm. It feels kind of quiet.
Well, the quiet is kind of nice because we have some kind of intense topics to talk about today, right?
Right.
So I understand that you have been covering a very interesting, you know, or sort of the beginnings of a very interesting case. And it all started with a dismemberment murder on June 2nd. And maybe I'm just going to, you know, ask you just a little bit about what actually happened on June 2nd.
Yeah. Well, the story begins a little bit before June 2nd, because the woman who was murdered disappeared about 2 weeks before that.
And okay.
So June 2nd was when her remains were found and the arrest was made.
And just so, you know, all of you are clear, a woman named, what's her name again?
Lisa Gonzalez.
Lisa Gonzalez. But, okay, Lisa Gonzalez was, police found a, a bag of decaying body parts.
Right.
In her house on June 2nd, and
So I can just sort of tell the story.
Okay, sure.
Unfolded, because it is a really sad but bizarre story.
Okay.
And so all the information we have right now is from just to preface this. Mm-hmm. The trial hasn't begun. The defense really hasn't put out any information because they're still collecting all the discovery. But so we have one court document filed by the DA, which goes into it goes into a lot of detail.
Uh-huh.
And it includes an interview that they had with Lisa Gonzalez.
Who is Lisa Gonzalez?
Lisa Gonzalez is the person accused of killing and then dismembering her 61-year-old roommate.
I see.
Lisa Gonzalez is 47. She's lived in the Mission her whole life. She's lived in this apartment on 14th Street her whole life. So what happened was, I'm going to start from the very beginning, so people just have a sense of this story.
Sure.
So last August, Lisa Gonzalez met Margaret Mamer at Whole Foods, and I think it was Lisa who was working at Whole Foods. And
Margaret Mamer, you know, is she like an old lady or?
She's 61 years old.
Okay.
And she presented herself to Lisa Gonzalez as having a really hard time finding a place to live in the city, that she had been this victim of unscrupulous landlords, of gentrification, and was sort of desperate. And Lisa Gonzalez had an apartment that she'd lived in since the 60s.
Where is this apartment?
It's on 14th Street.
Okay. 14th and?
It's 255 14th Street, I think it's. But okay, I don't actually, right. I should hold
that. Is that kind of close to Valencia or kind of close to Mission
closer
Street?
Closer to South Van Ness.
Okay. I see. Okay.
So, Lisa Gonzalez offered her a place to stay in her house, and Lisa was already living with another person, and they had a spare room. And so, Lisa offered her a $400 room to rent in the Mission, which is a pretty good deal if you have a background of evictions. You know, getting a $400 room is pretty good.
That's amazing.
But it kind of went south pretty quickly. Margaret Mamer started breaking things and losing things and misplacing things, and Lisa wanted her to move out.
How long did it take for this to happen?
I think it happened by January.
Okay.
So, you know, 4 months.
I see.
And Margaret Mamer seems to not have a lot of relatives or friends. There's one woman who lives in Maine who was her good friend and has spoken to the press about being really worried about her, about kind of talking to her on the phone and realizing she seemed really kind of desperate and was kind of overwhelmed by, you know, not getting along with the person she lived with, not maybe having enough money to afford rent. And Lisa, you know, on Lisa's end, Lisa asked her to move out. Asked her, I think in April, to move out. And Margaret just said no. I mean, she didn't have a place to go and she didn't want to move out.
Right.
And according to the court documents, Lisa Gonzalez told the prosecutors that they had a fight on May 15th.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't remember what happened next. But the other roommate in the house says, on May 15th, she came home from her job at lunchtime and smelled, it was a... like a foul odor from the bathroom, like a vinegar smell.
Wait, sorry, who is this? Who is this man?
This is the other roommate.
Oh, the other roommate.
So there was a third roommate.
Do we know her name?
We don't know her name.
Okay.
Or his name.
Oh, his name. Sorry.
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know the identity.
I see.
Smelled something foul coming out of the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to work, came back, smell had gotten worse. The next day she or he came back to the house and heard a sawing sound coming from the bathroom.
Oh, crap.
Yeah. And then a couple days later, this roommate asked Lisa, where did Margaret go? And Lisa said, she left in a way she shouldn't have.
What do you even call that kind of statement?
So, from, reading the court documents and reading, it sounds like, it does sound like a really, it's unclear what's happened at this point, but it's grim.
And so how long after all of, this exchange that you're describing, did police come and?
So it wasn't until 2 weeks later that the police made a visit to the house.
And what prompted that visit?
Well, Margaret's friend in Maine, mm-hmm. Issued reported a missing persons report.
I see.
And a friend of the other roommate actually went to the police because that roommate told them
right
what happened.
Wow.
And that
wow.
that they were concerned that uh-huh. their roommate had killed someone.
Wow.
So it was pretty, it was pretty overt.
I can't imagine what it's like to, hear that kind of thing, like she left in a way that she shouldn't have, and being the roommate there and like smelling this
right.
in the house, and like who would really think that it's something like this?
Right, it's hard to fathom. And we don't know the relationship. We're not, there's no the relationship between the two, Lisa and the uh-huh. other roommate is not confirmed.
Right.
And but you can imagine that they were close.
Right.
And there was, some real reservations and, deep ambivalence about, kind of accepting what maybe had happened
mm-hmm.
and telling people. I mean, obviously it took 2 weeks. And
Exactly.
So, what was going on through their head and what's, what's been the fallout is kind of, it's
interesting.
Yeah.
Now, So police, they come, and are they, what happens when police actually sort of step into the house?
Well, so they didn't have a warrant when they visited the
right.
house. They were just doing kind of like a welfare check.
Uh-huh.
So they went to the property, and Lisa opened the door, and she invited them in and said, yeah, you can look around, invited them right. to look around.
Uh-huh.
So they looked around, and then they meandered down to a communal storage space that mm-hmm. is shared by other tenants in the building.
Right.
And they smelled something, foul. And they went over to her locker, and she let them into her storage mm-hmm. locker.
Oh, I see.
And they found this big plastic bin. And that's when Lisa, according to the documents, she expressed reservations about them continuing to search. So at that point, they didn't open the box. They arrested Lisa. And they arrested Lisa
because they had probable cause. And...
Oh, you know what? Actually, I'm wrong. They did open the. Sorry. So they find the box.
Uh-huh.
There's a strong odor coming
right.
out of it.
Uh-huh.
They open the plastic bin, and uh-huh. inside is a large plastic bag covered in maggots.
Oh.
And there is a quote viscous liquid bubbling out.
Bubbling out. So and the DA used this language. Bubbling.
Language in the court documents it's filed.
Wow.
And these are from reports, the police reports.
Wow.
So at that point, that's when Lisa said, "Oh, maybe I don't want you to open what's in there," and that's when the police arrested her, and got a search warrant to to open the bag.
So they arrested her with probable cause.
Right.
Went to the court and got their warrant. Right. Came back and found, what did they find?
They opened the bag and they found Mamer's remains. Her arms and legs had been sawed off of her body. And, you know, after 2 weeks, body is probably pretty horribly decomposed. And so now it's been taken to the medical examiner's office where they're doing an autopsy.
Now, have we been able to sort of like understand how an autopsy is actually done on? A dismembered body?
I don't really understand how it's done. I mean, there are ways of examining the body to see, you know, how kind of blood operates. You know, when you cut into a dead body, the blood acts differently than when you cut into a live body because there's a heartbeat.
Oh.
So I think that's kind of a key kind of clue as to knowing, you know, the timeline of events.
I see.
Or, you know, timeline of traumas to a body.
Right.
So that's kind of where the trial is. The trial hasn't begun yet, but where the court proceedings have stalled, which is waiting for this autopsy, which is going to take, you know, it might take another month.
And what does, you know, what is the defense? Both sides, I guess. What does the autopsy say? And what is the defense especially sort of saying that the autopsy will say?
Well, the defense has, you know, so she's pleading not guilty. And she's being charged with first degree murder, you know, murder with malice. That's the charge. And so, you know, the defense is looking at that and they're probably thinking, and this is not from them because the defense has not spoken that much to the press, but they're probably thinking, okay, we're going to a jury trial. We need to create reasonable doubt that she murdered Margaret Mamer.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that, you know, something really horrible happened.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how Margaret Mamer died is still a mystery.
Right. Because, of course, it doesn't, you know, just because you have a bunch of body parts in your house doesn't necessarily mean you ultimately.
Right. Well, that seems to be where the defense is kind of hoping to go with their case.
Now, you were kind of able, you sat in the courthouse with Gonzalez, and, you know, I know that maybe it was not very brief, but what is she like in person? Could you just describe her?
So her appearances have been almost under a minute. They are so brief, you know, and the media has been pretty consistent in coming. The judge has allowed photos to be taken. So there's kind of each one of these hearing days, there's kind of a big media presence and everyone's kind of, you know, waiting for this one, you know, 30-second appearance. And she comes out, she keeps her eyes down. She's in an orange jumpsuit. She's not, you know, she's being held at the San Francisco jail without bail.
Mm-hmm.
She is just very, she has a very kind of neutral expression on her face.
I see.
She speaks very, when she has to sort of, you know, express consent to waive her right for a trial with a hearing within 60 days, which is what she's been doing, kind of postponing as they wait for the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
She speaks, you know, almost like a whisper.
And you know, would you, if you saw this woman on the street, would you expect, you know, would you expect that, I mean, of course it's easy, you know, when somebody's, you know, in like these sort of orange,
right.
In an orange jumpsuit, would you expect that, you know, she would have a Tupper bin and a bag of dismembered parts in her house?
No, I mean, not at all. I don't know who I would expect that from, but, no, I mean, she just, there's nothing out of the ordinary.
And so I understand too that she has said some, I don't want to say necessarily incriminating things, but you know, in an initial sort of interview with the cops, she said something. What did she say?
They asked her what happened. So she said they had a fight
mm-hmm.
On May 15th, mm-hmm. which is the at that, no one saw Margaret Mabor after May 15th.
Right.
They had a fight on May 15th because Margaret refused to move out.
Right.
And then she says, She says, I don't have any real recollection of what happened next.
Right.
Probably nothing good. And she says, I think I flipped. So those are the things she said. I mean, it's really, you know, I'll be interested to see if the defense makes a motion to strike those statements that she made, you know, without any, representation.
She didn't have representation.
She didn't have it. And then, yeah, at that point she asked for a lawyer.
Oh.
So I don't know how long the interview lasted, but those are the only, excerpts from the interview that were included in the court documents.
And just to be clear, she has pleaded not guilty.
Pleaded not guilty. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And it's interesting because, you know, the prosecutors could have chosen to charge her with a bunch of different crimes. You know, dismembering a body in and of itself is a crime.
Really?
But they didn't. They just focused on, they just charged her with murder. I don't think that's changed from the last time I looked at the filings. So, that's just, you know, an aspect of the case, an aspect of what they'll be having to prove at trial.
So right now we are waiting for, we have these sort of preliminary, hearings, and we're waiting for this autopsy, which they say will come out when?
It's not known. So the autopsy began, you know, around June 2nd when they found the remains.
Right.
The next hearing is scheduled for August 22nd. And I get the feeling that they're hoping that the autopsy results will have come by then. And that will have been, you know, almost 3 months. So that, you know, I think that there's reason to expect that the autopsy will be finalized at that point. I mean, at that point, then the case will move forward to preliminary hearings. And then it's just a matter of, I'm not totally sure what the next, like, you know, but it'll just sort of be a matter of collecting that evidence and then, you know, moving it towards a trial. And there's, you know, all of the process, all the sort of preliminary hearings to prepare for the trial.
Wow.
Will take place. And so that will include things probably like, you know, if the defense wants to move to strike certain types of evidence, like the interview without their representation, right, or things like that.
Right. Well, I can't wait to see what the next episode of this is.
It's going to be a long chapter in Mission Local's coverage.
Well, I really cannot wait. And yeah. I was actually out of town for this. And was it seemed like a very sort of interesting and also quite sad and harrowing story to cover, right?
Yeah, it is really sad. And, you know, it's one of those stories that, what's frustrating is that we may never really know what happened, because, you know, there's going to be a limit to how close you can get to it. But maybe not. Maybe maybe we can do some good reporting.
So I understand you also had a very sort of interesting experience, you know, or you felt you kind of happened upon this kind of interesting story on Mission Street. It was a new jiu-jitsu studio has opened up, or is just opening up on Mission Street.
It's already open.
It's already open.
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Empire Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
And, you know, why is this place interesting?
Well, so I went over there because you tipped me off to it. It's across the street from our offices, a few doors down. Uh-huh. And just to sort of, like, you know, new business opening up on Mission Street.
Right.
Turns out that the person who is, you know, started it, his name is Kurt Osiander, is kind of an internet sensation and a Brazilian jiu-jitsu sensation.
How do you pronounce that again?
Kurt Osiander.
Osiander,
yeah.
Okay, all right.
And he has this Move of the Week YouTube channel. You know, it's not hard to see why he would become such a sensation on the internet. He's got a big, ringleted hair. He's got tattoos all over his body. He's got a kind of, like, fuck you attitude.
He's got a fuck you attitude. And he really, I mean, you know, it's not just like his hair is like wrangled, like well, his hair is big, right?
Yeah, his hair is big. He's kind of like,
he looks
he's
like
kind of kind like of, you know, like he doesn't have this, the he's not
he looks a bit like a Neanderthal, perhaps.
He's if you can be aggressively laid back, like that's kind of how the attitude. Then you walk in there, it's like you feel like you are the uptight one, like uh-huh. and everyone in the studio kind of makes you feel that way.
Right.
And this is, and so turns out, as I was talking to him, the story of him coming to the mission is that he had a pretty serious falling out with Ralph Gracie, who's of the, you know, prominent Gracie family, which are credited with founding Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the 1920s
right.
in Brazil,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of like an offshoot of the more traditional Japanese Jiu-Jitsu.
So, and Jiu-Jitsu is what now? I mean, like,
it's like a martial arts.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I've never done it, so I don't know that much about it, but it's, right. It's a martial arts, kind of the idea of like you're using your own, like the small can defeat the strong by using kind of, you know, different kind of methods.
Sure, sure. So, sure. And so he was part of this Gracie thing. And
yeah. So he, you know, he grew up in San Francisco, wasn't really up to much. At age 28, his friend happened to be Caesar Gracie, who had gone into the Marines and then finally like uh-huh. took on the family business by uh-huh. Uh-huh. going into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And so that's how Kurt got into it,
right.
through a friend. And he said to me, it was the only thing I ever liked doing, so I figured I might as well make money mm-hmm. at it.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of just, you know, latched onto it, trained really rigorously, as he says, and became the main instructor at the Ralph Gracie Academy. And he was there for two decades. But as Ralph Gracie told me, it just got to the point. Well, so actually, Ralph Gracie maintains he didn't fire Kurt. Kurt, even though Kurt says he was fired.
So, but, you know, just maybe describe what the difference is between the two guys.
So,
and the two studios.
So I didn't visit the Ralph Gracie studio.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But Ralph Gracie didn't want an instructor swearing. He didn't uh-huh. want an instructor not sober.
Uh-huh.
He told me he wanted to teach respect, honor, and loyalty.
Right.
So, and get back to the real jiu-jitsu. And so, Kurt Osiander does not hide that he's not interested in that. And he's got a really irreverent, like...
So did he tell you that he was like on drugs at the studio?
No.
Okay. All right.
Not at all.
But he said that I want people who are sober.
Oh, did Ralph tell
me? Yeah.
He said that it's important for people who are, you know, getting over addiction, getting over alcoholism, to have a sort of drug-free environment.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, we can read that as we...
Yeah, you can take it.
And then what was it like being in the one on Mission Street in Osiander's lair?
I was there the first week. So I, you know, presumably they're still setting up. It's mm-hmm. very, you know, it's still kind of being still sort of in formulation. I saw him working with two kids. He was really sweet and kind of funny with them. And he seemed like a really good instructor.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I could also imagine, you know, not wanting to be, I don't know. It's hard for me to judge what I'd want out of a jiu-jitsu studio.
It just seemed to me like, you know, I was you know, kind of, I walked past, you know, this Empire Jiu-Jitsu, mm-hmm. and, you know, the sign is like wooden on the top and it's spray painted. And,
right.
you know, you have these dudes, you know, outside kind of with like long hair, kind of metal. It's other dudes just kind of with their shirts off, chilling. You know, and looking at kind of the Ralph Gracie, you know, pictures of that studio, it looks very much branded and everything is kind of, you know, shiny and squeaky clean. And,
professional.
Know, very professional. And so, you know, it seemed like, you know, this is going to be kind of, you know, this is very much in the vision of this guy who is, how tall is he, by the way?
He's not that tall. I don't know exactly how tall. He's like 5'8".
Oh, so he's not very tall at all.
Yeah.
But he's big.
He's like, yeah, he's strong. I mean, he's in his 50s now.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So he's...
You know, he's got this, you know, big hair, these, you know, like, you know, body covered, whole back covered in tattoos and, right?
Yeah.
And,
Yeah, Ralph Gracie has a buzz, like a military buzz cut.
Yeah, right. Okay. And so, you know, the contrast between these two are, you know, are very, you know, it's pretty stark.
Yeah, it's amazing that they lasted for 20 years together.
Right. Well, so... But we do, you know, welcome a new jiu-jitsu studio to the Mission.
Definitely.
Of course, right?
I think it could be a fun addition to the street.
It could be a fun addition to the street. We'll see. We'll see how it turns out and kind of what they bring. Well, that is unfortunately it for Listen Local. It's been a really fun time chatting with Charlotte today.
Thank you, Julian.
And yeah, we will see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for tuning in.